Welcome back to the Film Experience. I'm your host, Nathaniel R., and I'm here with Joe Reed from The Atlantic,
Hello.
Katie Rich from Vanity Fair,
Hello.
Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks,
Hello.
and we have a special guest today, Anne Marie Kelly from the Film Experience.
Hi.
And Anne Marie's here because we just got done with the AFI Festival in Los Angeles. We knew that you'd all be begging us for stories about it. So, what do you want to know?
I want to know if there's any part of A Most Violent Year that's better than the part in the trailer where Jessica Chastain says that was very
That was
disrespectful.
very disrespectful.
And she makes a little finger twirl. It's my favorite thing in pop culture right now. It's so good.
Yeah, as it should be.
That's one is hard to top, but she does have another hand motion in within the movie that is really hilarious.
Yeah.
Basically, anytime Jessica Chastain is on screen in that movie is gold, in my opinion.
And then how about the rest of the times?
I liked it.
I did too. It's beautifully shot, and Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain should do a lot more movies together.
Shot by the
Moneybags, yeah.
collective boyfriend of this podcast, right?
Yes, Brentford Young.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Wait,
And
Nick,
they.
I thought you had dibs on him. I thought you refused to let any of the rest of us go after him.
I'm glad you noticed my generosity right there. I was feeling like I was sharing.
When they were bringing the cast out at the beginning of the premiere, like they do, and they wave to you or whatever. They also brought out Bradford Young, and he sort of like does this really like awkward nod to the audience, and then he leaves the stage, and they're like, we j they just let him out of the he was doing color corrections on Selma,
He shot
so
that too?
yeah, he shot that too, so
What?
yeah, so that he we just brought him out here to say hi, and now he has to go, and then he like raced off the screen, and then at the Selma premiere. They didn't bring him up at all, and I had built him up so much because Paul Outlaw, who you know from the comment section,
Yeah.
I kept telling him that he was our boyfriend, Nick, and he was so excited to see him or meet him because there was a party and all this other stuff, and then he didn't even show to Selma.
He was too busy.
He's found
Or maybe
another.
maybe it wasn't color corrected yet, and he was too ashamed to see
He's stepping out on you with another podcast.
it.
So was the reaction to Selma as enthusiastic as some people made it sound?
Oh yes,
Yeah.
I was there. It was like standing ovation. It was crazy.
Like,
Wow.
compare it to other, because I feel like at festivals and things like that, like movies do get enthusiastic reactions like that. Compare it to like maybe other reactions to movies you've heard at festivals.
Well, it's a little tough to say. Okay, I have something to compare it to, and it's kind of a weird example, but Les Mis.
Wow.
Do you guys remember that first screening of Les Mis in New York that there was all these people online, including me, were like, "Oh my God," and the audience was just like went crazy.
I think that's the one when I was on the train back from Thanksgiving in Buffalo. It was like Thanksgiving Saturday, right?
I think so. And everybody just went
Yeah, it was.
crazy. And then, like, the next week, there was all this viciousness, and the viciousness never let up after that. I'm not saying Selma's going to be attacked that way because it's not. It's a much more traditional movie, so it won't upset people, you know?
Although sometimes that upsets people. And did you guys see American Sniper also?
You want to take this one, Anne?
So I did not go to Selma. I was standing in line for an hour and a half around the side of the Egyptian theater. Like, they were screening it at the Egyptian, and I got there at the screening was at 9. I got there at 7:15, and the line had already formed to the point where I was not in front of the Egyptian. I was actually on a side street next to a parking lot in line for a very, very long time. And I got my number, and there are I got number 245, and I was so excited because I was gonna get in because there are so many seats. They cut off the line at like 240.
Oh no.
Wow.
I could see it, and I couldn't get in.
Yeah,
Ugh.
the really weird thing about the AFI, which is not true of a lot of festivals, is that if you have a press badge, there aren't separate screenings for press, so you just get in line with everybody else. So if it's like a hot ticket, you have no preferential treatment. So a lot of press hate that because they show up and they're like, "How can I do my job? I didn't even get to write about half the movies I was going to go see."
Yep.
So for those things, like the special events within it, you have to do like what we were doing, where we would contact the publicist, and then we would be at WillCon. We could just go in. We didn't have to wait in any line or whatever. But you have to have planned it with the studio or the publicist or whatever.
Since it was a secret screening, they weren't even doing that. Like, I reached out, and they're like, "Nope, you can stand in line with everybody else." I'm like, "Oh, great, thanks, guys."
So Selma was a secret screening, and American Sniper was a secret screening.
Well, Selma was meant to be a 30-minute preview.
But Oprah
convinced Ava that since it was almost finished, she should seize the day and just... Wow. So Ava...
You do not say no to Oprah.
You could have stopped that sentence at, "but Oprah."
When we met Ava, she was on 40 hours of no sleep.
Wow.
Because they were locking the picture. So there was only a couple of shots that were a little weird, because they hadn't...
All the big CGI scenes had to be storyboard form.
But since she couldn't get into American Sniper, I took her to the Selma party, so all was well.
Yes, and I met Lorraine Toussaint, and I said absolutely nothing. I mostly just stared.
That's a good one. That's a good encounter.
And they brought up chocolate chip cookies while we were talking to her, and we all ate them together.
Did you guys see that Middle of Nowhere finally comes out on DVD in January?
I know, it's so funny. I'm like, what timing?
Unfortunately. Well, anyway, it'll be good to have it available.
Well, anyway, yeah, buy it.
Yeah, it's really good.
Go buy Middle of Nowhere.
It's really good. The other thing, since you guys aren't asking, the other thing is we got to be inside the Dolby twice.
It's true. I actually went in 3 times because I went in for a talk back at 1.2.
Okay, so... Using the layout of where people were sitting at some ceremony we've all watched, whose seats were you in? Like, where were you? Where did you go? Who did you pretend to be? Those are my many questions.
Well, the very first time for Most Violent Year, what did we decide we were in those seats, Anne-Marie? Whose seats were they? Costume designers?
Yeah, or a technical award of some kind. We were pretty far back.
But we were in the orchestra, you know, like the main floor.
You were where they handed out the makeup award that one year when they were handing out awards in the seats.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, where Andrea Arnold got her live action short Oscar.
Oh, right. Yeah, but for The Gambler, I think we decided there that we were directors who were nominated but were long shots.
Yeah, we were dark horse directors. We were off to the side, but closer to the screen.
The Ben Zeitlin seats.
Yes.
Same thing. That's awesome.
I was going to say Michael Haneke seats. Same deal.
Same year. Same good. Yep.
But it is. Yeah, it was really exciting to be inside.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, and they've got... Oh, well, they've got these huge pictures up on the sides of various Oscars moments that you could... We took lots of pictures with them because when else am I going to get the opportunity to take a picture with Meryl Streep holding her Oscar?
I saw Nathaniel's version of that photo. It's pretty priceless.
Yes, his is much better than mine. But yeah, it's so specifically designed for one purpose, and it's really rare that you see a theater that's like only designed for that one thing.
Yeah,
right.
And it's very devoted to it.
Although I was surprised at the lack of bar space.
Well, they have a bar on every floor, though.
Yeah, but the bar to go in the main floor where all the stars go, there was only one, and it was small. Because we waited in that line for drinks with David Oyelowo.
That's true.
Oh my god, say that again slowly. So, like, straight talk, do we have to see The Gambler?
Yeah, please tell me I don't have to.
I don't think you have to.
Yay!
We talked a little bit about John Goodman afterwards.
Ugh.
Nick is quitting this podcast. He cannot handle this.
If that's the selling point, I'm out.
I keep trying to make the John Goodman case every year, and after that year where he was in Flight and Argo. If that wasn't going to happen, then like I don't know.
Well, it's very similar to those in that it's a super super showy character that shows up once in a while.
Yeah.
You're saying that John Goodman acts at high volume in this movie?
Yes.
So weird.
Same with Jessica Lange.
Yes.
Okay, they're not the same. Don't say that.
Well, no, but they're both brought in for a similar reason, which is they're brought in for like showpiece scenes that they, you know, proceed to leave teeth marks on all of the scenery and then leave.
Right. How many David Bowie songs does Jessica Lange sing in this movie?
None, and I would have graded it so much higher if there had even been half of one.
Okay, all right.
For our girl Brie Larson, I'm kind of already mad about her having to be Mark Wahlberg's love interest at the age of 24.
Me too.
So am I right?
Oh, yeah.
I'm so mad about it.
And why don't you tell them like how crucial her role is to the movie?
Not at all.
Oh, God.
Not even at all. They spend a lot of time building up how smart she is, and then she does nothing with it.
They actually call her. They actually call her in her first scene a genius. She's literally called a genius, and then the movie has no interest in her.
Nope.
This is all very frustrating.
It was frustrating to sit through.
But it's good to know that I have this free pass to not see it then.
Right. And there was also a Q&A after the Q&A woman bombed very badly because she was kind of... It was like she made James Lipton's love of whoever he's interviewing look like standoffishness.
Was Jessica Lange rolling her eyes in the auditorium?
She wasn't there.
I was so disappointed.
She wasn't there and Brie wasn't there, but I don't blame Brie after seeing her role.
Yeah.
I don't blame Jessica Lange.
But John Goodman was there.
He was, yeah. He pretended to leave the stage like twice.
Also stealing the Q&A.
Mm-hmm.
Just so surprised by that.
So yeah, it was a good week.
It was a good week. I can say that now because I've slept.
Yes.
So what's the one thing that happened at AFI that like changed your thoughts on the Oscar conversation most? Like, did a person like make their case that you didn't think was a thing before? Did somebody drop out of contention? Like what?
I mean, most of the movies were not new. I mean, so the only things that really showed their...
NFL Mobile is now free with more everything.
Sorry, that's me. I was trying to keep track of the football score, and they do a dumb thing at halftime.
Are you pirating this podcast?
Yes, right? I am.
Do you sell it in the subway?
I'm going to watermark this podcast so you have to look at your own name, and everyone will know it was you.
Oh... Yeah,
this podcast,
I mean, I would say that the biggest takeaway I had from it is because I already suspected Selma was going to be a big deal, so that didn't really change my opinion. I think I was just right to assume it was going to be a big deal, but
own it.
Yeah, but I have no idea what to predict in terms of Bradford Young's cinematography chances because of both of those movies, because. A Most Violent Year is much showier visually, but, you know, they tend to go for best pictures
right.
For those prizes, and so maybe he won't get nominated at all. I don't know. But because I was kind of, like, waiting to see those to think, because I'm waiting for him to get his first nomination. And the other thing is, like, Jessica Lange, I think it's going to happen for a supporting actress.
Really?
Oh, wow.
For this Wait movie, a minute. Just told us
did
we don't
earlier
have
to tell us we didn't have to see this movie, and now you're telling
me. No, that was The Gambler. I said you didn't have to see.
Wait, what's Jessica Lange in that?
Oh, my God. I said Jessica Lange. Jessica Chastain. Oh, my God.
You guys are really excited about Jessica Lange.
She also left
her teeth. This podcast is stressing me out.
She also left her teeth mark in the scenery.
Yes, she did. Well, teeth marks and claw marks from those fantastic nails, yeah.
And she's truly supporting, I ask, the Commission on Category Fraud?
It's one of those, it is really Oscar Isaac's movies. Like, you leave her quite often. Like, she doesn't really have scenes without him. So it's kind of like a co-lead that could be described as supporting. It's right on the line. So I'm not going to object to it.
Okay.
Did you wish that her part had been played by Mariah Carey in Precious?
Absolutely not. I was loving every second of it.
It's pretty impossible to love anybody or to wonder how anybody else would have approached the role. She does a great job with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really fun performance in a movie that otherwise is very grim. So so it really pops.
Nathaniel, if she does get nominated and you do your breakdown of why she got nominated, What percentage of it will be fingernails?
18%.
Okay. All right.
They're like Barbara Streisand level fingernails, like 60s Barbara Streisand type claws that we're talking about here.
Nice.
It would be higher because the fingernails really are a big selling point, except for there's of the hand gestures that really emphasize those fingernails. There's only two scenes that really knock it out of the park.
Okay.
One that you've already seen and are already mimicking amongst yourselves.
One you've already seen in like 32% to the hair. So you can't, you know.
Yeah.
That's like 50% that's already gone.
Right. So anyway, that was our week. Oh, and they celebrated Sophia Loren.
They did. They did celebrate Sophia Loren.
And
she was kind of everywhere.
Yeah, and the really funny part is we went to Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, both of us.
Mm-hmm.
Only we didn't realize the other one was there. So I sat in the balcony and Anne-Marie sat in the normal part of the theater. And there was all this like hubbub in the balcony about that Sophia Loren was actually there at the screening, even though her tribute was like a few days after that. And it turned out to be a Sophia Loren impersonator.
Sure.
She was sitting two rows behind me and people kept walking up to her. She did a great Sophia Loren. I gotta say, like, I was fooled and I was sitting two rows in front of her. The only reason I knew it wasn't her is people kept walking up and saying, "Oh, Miss Loren, can you sign this? I love your work." And she would say, "Oh, no, I am a professional Sophia Loren impersonator. Here is my email."
In case anyone wants to hire me, it was smart to show up there.
Hire me for your next.
That's because it was too embarrassing to say, "I'm Renee Zellweger. I'm not."
Although, I gotta say, talking about standing ovations, she got a 2-minute long standing ovation when she entered and when she exited Sophia Loren at her tribute. Like, people were going nuts for her.
Did they include the clip from the 2008 Oscars where she put her hands on her hip and goes, "Meryl Streep"?
I wish.
Because that's my favorite thing she's ever done in her entire career.
I think I'm going to put that in the clip reel at your honorary Oscar, Joe.
Thank you, Katie.
Seems like the proper acknowledgement.
That plus any Meryl scene from The Hours.
Yes.
Yes. Crab thing, mostly.
Egg yolks.
I feel as if I'm unraveling. Isn't that one of her lines?
Oh, it sure is.
For those of you playing at home, bingo is now complete. Show your cards, bring them to the front.
Well, I guess we have to move on from AFI. But it was fun. Anne-Marie, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on briefly.
Thank you.
Yeah, and have a good week. And now you can sleep. I won't be calling you every day. Now you have to write about this.
And your Katharine Hepburn series is still awesome and essential reading.
Oh, thank you, Nick.
And almost done.
All right, goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Nice meeting you.
Now Katie's going to know what it feels like when people in comments are like, "Wait, who said the thing?"
I know, which one is which. Yeah. Women can't be on a podcast together without being confused for each other. It's literally impossible.
Okay, so the other bad news is that I didn't see Citizen Four. Which we were going to talk about. So if you guys want to briefly talk about it right now, you can. And I will listen intently.
I guess the nice thing about like not having seen Citizen Four is we can't exactly spoil anything for you because like
right. But what I want to know why people like flipped out for a split second when it first screened, and then I haven't really heard about it since.
Honestly, I think it's because a lot of people, and I'm going to put myself squarely in this camp, didn't know as much about the Edward Snowden news as they thought they did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think you can follow the news at a level that like I do, which is like close enough to get by. Mm-hmm. But like, it really the full picture of this whole event really is eye opening, and I think seeing it through the like right up close with him, like in the hotel room in Hong Kong, like before the story breaks, as they are breaking it, like, is pretty fascinating. And it's that front row seat thing that like even the best documentaries don't have the kind of luck that this one did.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it really makes it feel like a special moment where, and I think the filmmaking is strong and I think the film makes some really interesting choices, but I think also it's just an incredibly fortunate front row seat to have at that moment in time.
But it's not even like fortunate in the sense that he made a really conscious choice for it to be recorded this way, right? Like, this was the filmmaker of everyone in the world was who he decided should be there when he hands the stuff over.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, you saying that it was as this story broke, so it's incredible luck. It's a little bit like The Hurt Locker, because they were making that without an ending.
You mean
isn't that correct?
Zero Dark Thirty.
I'm sorry, The Hurt Locker.
You are Chastain is creating a time rift where you can't see beyond the horizon today.
Wow.
I think it's the Pfeiffer hair. I think it's really disturbed you.
Yeah.
In probably good ways.
I am so sorry. Okay, yes. Zero Dark Thirty.
It's like Zero Dark Thirty in that way, but the lack of fiction kind of makes it even more powerful, because you're watching, it's like being on the grassy knoll, or like, or instead of the book depository, or like in the balcony with Lincoln, or like some amazing thing that you can't believe exists for you to share and be part of. And Edward Snowden is a human being. Like, I realized I had never watched that video interview, that screenshot was the only picture we had of him for months and months. I'd never watched it. I don't think I'd ever heard him talk out loud.
Yeah.
And kind of seeing him as a human being, and like really spending a lot of time looking at him and wondering why he's doing what he's doing. And never, I don't think I really got a satisfactory answer. And I admire the film for that, because I think it's really hard to answer that for somebody else. And I liked that it kind of presented him up close in that way without trying to really turn him into a martyr or turn him into a saint, but just presented who he is.
So it wasn't like psychoanalyzing.
Biographizing probably isn't a word, but like, I don't know that much more about his personal history than I knew already. Like, I just don't want to go that way.
He really resisted too. There's a part where they try, like, I think Glenn Greenwald is trying to get him to talk about himself, and he's like, I'm not the story. I want to give as few details about myself as possible so that it's not about who I am, it's about this information. And the movie does a really good job of kind of respecting that while also presenting him as a fascinating human being.
I mean, it does put the movie in the position of, and I wrote about this as much as you can in 140 characters, but of the movie really doesn't want to do that, but also the whole hook that this movie has is having him right in front of you, so it does prompt some of those moments of, like, this is him brushing his teeth, or, like, waiting for an email, or where you sometimes are just kind of looking at him in a way that sometimes felt a little weird, but completely riveting. Like, I agree with both of you. It was just so engaging.
I think that's the thing that I took away from it, is it takes you no time at all to put yourself right in this situation. You are in this hotel room with them, and that sense of paranoia gets transferred to you so seamlessly and so quickly, and that sense of sort of trepidation and also, like, nerve, like, you really get a sense of, I think, the reasons why he's doing this, Katie, I think you're right, sort of still seem a little, you know, they don't really investigate, like, they don't psychoanalyze, like you guys said, but I think just his sense of resoluteness that he is doing this, and, like, this is, you know, what he has to do, and he's going to sacrifice everything to do it. I don't know, like, that sense just really transfers powerfully to the audience.
There's this amazing scene where they're testing a hotel fire alarm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Three people in the room are freaked out that we're, like, in full-on born supremacy Treadstone territory, and that can't just be a fire alarm. But then maybe it is. And just watching them deal with, like, something that's probably completely mundane but could completely not be is...
Yeah.
Unforgettable.
And I also, even the stuff that we have seen in the news, like, I remember when Glenn Greenwald's partner was detained and whatever, and, like, that was a huge story.
Yeah.
And watching from this angle, it felt even different than that, even though it's basically the same. You get that same footage of them in the airport or whatever. But then you get that added scene of just, like, the two of them in the elevator afterwards, and it's just, like, it doesn't even show you much beyond, you know, on a surface level, much beyond what you saw in the media when it happened.
Right.
But you're all of a sudden from a different perspective. You're watching it from the inside now. And it that moment to me, I thought, was really kind of really struck me. Just how freaked out these people are, and how, you know, how personal it is and has become for them now.
So do you guys, so do you guys think it's going to be like? Is it you know, like with documentaries, there's always a thing about form, and a lot of them don't push any sort of envelope. Do you think it's is it really accessible? Like, do you think the Oscars will go for it?
I think so.
It's totally accessible.
It's pretty. It's very accessible because it's so. I mean, it's really simple. It's really straightforward, and it makes the extent of the leaks like it doesn't really get too much in the weeds about like what they're watching and how they're spying on us. It does it enough to make you understand how powerful and how important it is, which is not easy to do.
And it certainly makes, you know, its own implicit case for the importance of filmmakers and how much we need documentarians who are this ready to jump on a story so everybody could feel good about themselves for voting for it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Unless we get one of those nomination fields where there are four of these political documentaries and then something about cute monkeys, and then that wins. But let that be an incentive to all you cute monkey profilers out there that you have an opening.
What do we think is the major competition for this in documentary this year? I feel like I have a much looser hold on this category this year than I did last year.
Well, I mean, part of the problem is we don't have the finalist list yet. We just have we just have that long 130 film list.
But I feel like everybody has sort of agreed that this is going to be a big contender. Are there other movies that have had that kind of consensus?
Well, I put I made it in the chart. I tried to put ones. So I'll just read what I have in the chart and see if you guys think I'm right on here. So Citizen Four, Elaine Stritch, Shoot Me, The Overnighters, Red Army, which I do think it's going to be a nominee.
From hearing people talk about that one, I think so.
It's very entertaining. And it's a subject matter that everybody will have some way in because the Olympics and the Cold War and all that stuff. Afternoon of a Fawn, The Case Against Eight, National Gallery. They never nominate Frederick Wiseman films.
Ever.
Though. No, they don't.
Rich Hill. Point and Shoot, that got a couple nominations already at things. 20,000 Days on Earth, the Nick Cave movie.
Okay.
Keep on Keeping On, got a humanitarian prize, some jazz movie or something. Watchers in the Sky, Art and Craft, a lot of these have had already like attention. Life Itself.
Yeah, that seems like a big
Life
one.
Of-
Yeah, I feel like Life
Isn't Itself. Life Itself the one people are afraid is going to jump in and beat Citizen Four and then everyone's be ashamed of themselves?
Well, I don't think
Itself is actually not the movie that a lot of people who haven't seen it might think it is. Like, it definitely is not about putting a halo on top of Roger Ebert. Like, you feel
that's
good,
good
about him, but...
That's been my thought in not wanting to see it.
Yeah, it's a really multi-sided portrait. And it's interesting on the marriage, it's interesting on the Siskel stuff, it's really interesting on how he got to the position that he got to. It does feel like a Steve James movie and not just like a kind of...
Okay, then I should see it,
I should stop resisting.
I will end up seeing it, for sure. I would say, the ones you mentioned, The Overnighters is so good, and so surprising, and so interesting, and that's highest recommendation for people to see that when they get a chance to.
So let's talk Theory of Everything.
And it's okay. It's all right.
I love how...
Eddie Redmayne is really cute, you guys.
Eddie Redmayne's very good. He's easily the reason, I would say, to see this movie, and I think maybe the only reason to see this movie.
Oh my god, you guys. I bring up Citizen Four, and you're all instantly like, blah, 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 blah. And this one, you're like,
Citizen Four is a much more interesting movie than Theory of Everything. Theory of Everything does not have a ton of things to inspire discussion, as far as I'm concerned.
I liked it kind of, but my issue with it is I think it is trying to be two different movies.
What are those?
The first one is a movie about a difficult marriage,
mm-hmm.
and the second one is a Stephen Hawking biopic.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's nimble enough to do both super well. So it kind of is something in between both of them.
I totally know what you're saying, and I think that's what I liked about it. I kind of really liked this movie. I was surprised. I was sort of resistant to even wanting to deal with it, but I don't know. I mean, it didn't feel... Reading backwards, it's hard to... I was expecting pretty standard biopic beats. Mm-hmm. And then it goes in this really different direction. And in retrospect, it never felt to me like the movie changed what it was doing. It was just the whole time setting up a more personal story than the kind of biopic review. Mm-hmm. I can't figure out what I would take out if I were trying to get rid of standard biopic elements that wasn't serving the story they wound up telling eventually. Mm. Especially when they immediately skip over, like, yeah, then they had some kids, whatever. Which a lot of movies would have spent so much time on. I'm right. a scientist, well, but I still sometimes like to have love and kids.
I mean, I was grateful that it skipped over some of that stuff, but then also when it gets to the end of the movie and, you know, you've watched this difficult marriage fail and, or, you know, end, and then you kind of see, yeah, sorry. you get to the end of the movie and it's like, he says to her, like, this is what we've accomplished. Like, this is this great thing we've done together, when neither he nor the movie seemed to really give a shit about the family that much. And yeah. it felt really disingenuous. I guess I kept having this feeling throughout that Stephen Hawking was a gigantic jerk who was being let off the hook for being a giant jerk because he was a genius. And I didn't understand why that story couldn't be part of it, or if the movie didn't think he was a jerk. And I was very thrown off on the way they were trying to depict this character. And I eventually felt like they were just trying to gloss over these less savory elements of his personality.
Well, it's interesting, right? That she's painted as the one who, like, is the cheater of the two of them. Like, if you were to sort of put it on, like, a scale, like, who's the bigger cheater? She is. Mm-hmm. Like, there are reasons and whatever, and, like, it's justified and, like, whatever, blah, 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 Charlie Cox. But I feel like that seems to be maybe not necessarily true to life, or at least not, or it's weighted in a way that sort of, when, by the time you get to the part where he leaves her for the nurse or whoever, whatever function she's serving in his life, you're just sort of like, well, sure, like, Felicity Jones already, like, had sex with Charlie Cox on the fateful night of his blah 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 blah. Like, that to me felt very kind of
accusatory, right?
Yeah, that heavy part, yeah. In a way that I didn't appreciate. I felt like I was being nudged in a few directions that I didn't appreciate.
My favorite part of the movie is the marital portrait, so it's just like the biopic elements that I didn't respond to, or I guess maybe the glorification of Stephen Hawking, because I think that kind of goes without saying, because there's already so much material about that, and what I found interesting was the marriage. So my actual favorite part of the movie is when, I forget his name already, but when Charlie Cox sort of enters their lives.
Yeah.
Because that mm-hmm. felt very, like, it's not a love triangle, but it's also not that.
Yeah.
And it felt very sort of daringly alternative in the way it was, like, dealing with that.
I agree.
That was my least favorite part of the movie. Everything with him and, like, he's, like, playing the church organ and, like, I don't know. Like, it all felt kind of silly and, like, predetermined. Like, you know, you could... His role in this is so prescripted that I had a really hard time taking it as seriously and really, like, sort of, like, losing myself in that part of the story.
Interesting.
Yeah, I like the stuff that was about...
I'll say no more. I mean, I'm the here.
No, I'm just so excited that I feel like I'm usually so crabby in these podcasts, and I never like anything the most of the four of us. It's so great. But
didn't you think... Okay, I do want to say one negative thing, because I liked it too, but, like, didn't you think the cinematography was a little gilding the lily? It was so golden and, like,
I don't get his relationship to cinematography. Yeah, it just feels like even in his documentaries, like, he just loves to overexpose and have some glare and be like, what if this table was glowing? Like, I don't know why. So, yeah, I agree with you about that. But I felt like, I don't know, I feel like a lot of movies about whether they're real people or not real people, about either disability or some incredible challenge or some, or you've got, like, you know, the public story versus, like, the private home life story. I feel like the private home life always gets kind of turned into, like, the bedrock of things that don't change while this other big thing is changing, like the whole mm-hmm. kind of Jennifer Connelly putting his hand on her heart and being like, this is real, this is, you know, the constant. And I liked that the movie asserted that that's not how it works, that, like, when your circumstances are changing professionally or they're changing medically, like, your emotional needs also change, and that
it was just such a different idea than this is the thing you can always count on. That, and I just wasn't expecting the movie to raise things that complicated. And I thought the way they handled the science versus God stuff too was in some sense a little bit fuzzy, but I was happy to have fuzziness instead of like weird position taking or
yeah,
one's better than that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is why I didn't like what Joe was mentioning with the on the fateful night, because that felt too, you know, unbalanced. But I did like that it gave both of them the space to. It's nice that it understood it was a two lead movie and not a Stephen Hawking movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think Charlie Cox is just a doll in it. I thought he was adorable, but also just really good. I would have liked that scene probably less if his reaction weren't so memorable to me. I feel like we just got to home base and I have to backwards run all the way to second again, like immediately, was so poignant to me.
Yeah. Not to Joe. Deadly silence.
Nope. Sorry. I won't rain on your parade anymore.
Rain away.
I hate Felicity Jones, you guys. I just...
You do have a Felicity really Jones hang-up that is bigger than all of us.
I can't deal. I just...
What is it?
It's a big old nothing. It's just there's... I feel like I'm being asked to find her captivating in a way that I never do. Even Invisible Woman, I liked her in. That's easily the best thing I liked her in.
I agree.
But I think that even played into, you know, I think that played into my preconceptions about her in a way that worked, where it's just sort of like she's this very kind of ordinary woman and she's, you know, playing this. Whereas I feel like in this and in what's the one I really hated?
Like Crazy.
With Anton Yelchin.
Like Crazy?
Oh, Like Crazy.
Like Crazy. God, I hated Like Crazy. And I hated her and Like Crazy. And in this too, and it's just sort of like she's this, you know, luminescent and sparkling and who wouldn't fall head over heels? And it's just like, I guess. I find her so boring. I do.
I actually thought she was good in this one, but I generally have had that reaction in the past. Also, so I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Alright, so that was Theory of Everything, a mixed response.
Did you like how Emily Watson got the Toni Collette role?
Oh, God.
I'm not, it's fine.
I can't even think about it.
I don't even know why I'm in this home movie. You've never seen me before. You should go to church. Bye.
I don't understand why people who are known quantities take those parts. I really don't.
I'm assuming there had to be more there at one point. Or it was like, I can do this role and it's 2 blocks from my house?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're going to pay me
Yeah. Yeah.
And it'll buy
they're
me
gonna, new, gonna do that day,
it'll
so
buy me a new
well.
Car.
Yeah.
Or a new seat cushion in my car.
New fuzzy dice for the interview, yeah, something.
She definitely seems like a fuzzy dice kind of person.
Doesn't she?
Well, she did. Well, she did.
Joke. You guys just took that so seriously. It made me sound mean.
Well, she did seem like that in Punch Drunk Love.
That's true.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, everyone. Next week, we'll be talking Interstellar, Imitation Game, and Best Actress. Bye.